follow me down this deep, dark hole.
To New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent working in the horror genre today, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm chatting to writer-director Dodo Dayo about his new film, Midnight in a Perfect World. Over the course of the interview, I chat to Dodo about his tight 11-day shoot, about his many horror influences, and the film's great success at the numerous festivals it has played worldwide. Elsewhere in the interview, we talk about Filipino cinema, the scary rise of populist right-wing leaders in the world over the last 5 years, including in the Philippines itself, and on a much lighter note, we share our joint appreciation of the film Under the Skin, all of which and much more you can hear right now in my interview with Dodo. Hi Dodo, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Scott.
That's no problem, it's a pleasure to have you on. So we've got you on today to talk about your film Midnight in the Perfect World. Can you first of all tell us a little bit about the initial inspiration for Midnight in a Perfect World?
I actually dreamt about the basic premise of the film, the whole idea of a blackout happening randomly in a city and a safe house. But I didn't do anything with it until many years later, because I didn't think it was going to be something that I could sort of like make into a film. But a few years later, a friend of mine commissioned a short film for me that was sort of like a horror interpretation of what was going on in the Philippines. This was after 2016. We just got a new president, and the rash of extrajudicial killings had started. So I thought I could spin this into a short film, maybe just have that whole just do a script based almost exactly on the dream. Yeah. But when that didn't push through, I was supposed to pitch something else to Globe, who eventually produced the film. So I sort of decided to like make a really quick pitch deck the night before, and without really realizing or knowing how to extend it further than the short, I sort of pitched it, and it sort of got green-lighted during the first meeting. And now I had the problem of how to expand the vision of the film. But I think it's really based on stories that my parents told me about martial law back in the 70s and 80s. When you had curfews, it was sort of like a mythical thing when I was growing up, because it didn't affect me. I was still very little. But they kept telling us about the curfew that happens in Manila during martial law. After midnight, nobody's allowed out on the streets. And if you get caught, the rumor was you never get seen again. So that was sort of like a big thing for little kid sort of process. It was sort of like a ghost story. So that stuck with me. My uncle got caught out once during curfew, and it turned out to be anticlimactic. They just spent the night in jail. That's it. That was it. So that sort of diffused the whole boogeyman aspect of it. But when I grew old enough to realize what really was going on during martial law, all the torture and all the oppression that was happening, then it had another it gained another layer for me, and it sort of stuck with me throughout my adult years. But again, never occurred to me to make a film out of it until I had the dream and all these events happened, and it sort of like fell into place.
I was kind of wondering, like, I'd read a bit about that, and I read a bit about the kind of allegorical kind of stuff, and I was wondering, like, what you thought. Like, do you think the film is richer for people who are aware of, like, the Marcos regime back in the 70s and 80s, or the like, the current Duterte regime that's at the moment?
Yeah, I think it works both ways. I think a lot of people who were aware of martial law sort of picked up on it, mm-hmm. on the resonance. But the very same people who were aware of it were also aware of what was going on at the present. So you sort of had that parallel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of younger people who only grew up or are only aware of the Duterte regime sort of picked up on that. It's not really that difficult to sort of like separate, because pretty much the same thing is happening.
Right.
I think the interesting layer, though, for the audience was that it got shown. It wasn't intended to be shown during the pandemic, but when it got shown during the pandemic, that gave the film a layer that we didn't expect it would have. So everybody was picking up on that, too, that it felt like a very pandemic film in a lot.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. Yeah. I was wondering, like, I don't know if you've managed to attend a lot of the festivals it's been at, or if any, but I was wondering if there has been any kind of differences in reactions between audiences at home in the Philippines and like Western audiences.
I was able to attend a virtual Q&A for the film during the Neuchâtel Fest, and the questions that they were asking me were pretty much the same. I think they were picking up mostly on the pandemic aspect of it. Mm. And I think it's because the Duterte regime has been all over the news ever since 2016. So I think there's some kind of at least very tangential knowledge of what was going on here. So they were picking up on it pretty much. The only difference with local audiences is local audiences could be more specific about the resonance that they got from the film. They're more looking into the details of the film, yep. rather than a more general kind of like overview of what he wanted to say.
Because
I think for some odd reason, 2016 sort of like brought in a lot of despots into power. So I think worldwide there's this awareness of that kind of totalitarian kind of rule that was happening in more places than ours. So maybe that's what they were picking up also. But they were very keen on the political layer of the film, at least in that particular Q&A.
Yeah. I can understand that, because I think like there is a tangential, you know, even here in Scotland there is a tangential knowledge of anybody who reads the news of the Duterte regime, because it is kind of bundled in with like you say, 2016 seems to be this kind of watershed moment for nationalist politics in a lot of ways. And Trump and Brexit happened here, and then over the last 5 years you've had the likes of Duterte, and then Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Oberon in Hungary, and all these different other people that have just kind of risen kind of recently to horrible effect. And I think there is that kind of, that is all in the air. So I think people are very conscious of this rise of far right politics, of nationalist politics, that has kind of happened over the last 5 years. to depressing effect.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it's sort of like part of the zeitgeist already, and it's easy to sort of pick up those signals from a film like this, even if it was sort of like calling back something that was in a more a few decades back in the past, specifically calling back to that. I think it sort of like echoed. Whether it was intentional or not, it sort of echoed what was going on at the present.
Kind of talking a little bit more about the current politics. I've had a couple of Brazilian guests on before, and they've talked a lot about how, you know, the Bolsonaro regime is very anti-culture, so it's very hard to get funding. How is the situation in the Philippines?
To be fair, we have a film council that's sort of doing its job.
Oh, okay.
But I think there's a lot of energy and effort being put into looking into co-productions, international co-productions for a lot of independent filmmakers here. So that exists, and I think it's a good thing. It's not as prolific as some of us would like it to be, but there's really no sense of censure yet in that sense, or oppression in terms of on a cultural level. Not yet, at least, but there's only 1 year left to this regime, so we're all kind of hopeful that it ends when it does. So it was, I heard it was much worse during the Marcos time.
But you weren't, like you were saying, you were a kid at that time, so you weren't really truly conscious of what was going on there.
Yeah, it's all like sort of like secondhand history to me when I was starting to become more aware of cinema back in the day and what was going on politically. So yeah, that's sort of like in hindsight. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty much normal in a lot of ways.
So kind of cutting back to the making of the movie, kind of how long did it take between getting your final script together and going into shooting?
It was very, very fast. I mean, I think this is one of the fastest projects I've ever worked on, because after it got green-lighted on January, and around Feb, I was already asked to write a script. I didn't have a script at all. I didn't even have a clue how to tell a story beyond the basic premise. So I was asked to start writing a script around Feb, and I finished a draft around March or April, and we continued to revise it until around June. That's as far as I remember. And then we were shooting in September. So it's a really, really very fast process for us. And for me, I wasn't used to, we're sort of used to films being made really fast here in the Philippines. It's always been, historically, that's always been par for the course as far as films are concerned. Even back in the day, films were made really, really fast. Mm-hmm. But even if I'm sort of used to that, this still sort of surprised me. Maybe because the process of writing the script happened faster than I usually write a script. Maybe that's the thing that sort of impressed upon me how fast things were going. But yeah, it was really, really fast.
And how long was the shoot? I know a lot of the indie directors I talk to, it's really tight shoots of only 2, 3, 4 weeks.
I wish I had 4 weeks. I had, I think, 11 days.
11 days. That is super tight. Yes,
super tight. But and it was, we had to stagger it because two of the main actors were also doing a lot of TV. So we had to work around their schedules. And necessarily we had to stagger it because we had to shoot outside of Manila also, and we had shoots inside a studio. So we had 11 days and no pickups. I wish I had a day for pickups, but no, we didn't even have an extra day. But that's pretty long for the kind of films that I do. My first feature film, we had a week, but also staggered. We had 7 days or 8 days, roughly. So I kind of had more days with this one.
And did you feel that there was a big difference between directing your feature debut Violator and directing this one?
As a big difference in budget. I think we had 6 times more than what we had in Violator. And that was sort of like liberating for us. I mean, it's still not the sort of budget a lot of filmmakers here in the Philippines would want to work with. It's because it's kind of tight, relatively. But for us, for me in particular, and my team, that was more than we've ever worked with. So it was kind of liberating. It was kind of freeing that we could have that much lassitude in the shoot, because we could afford to do a lot of things that back then we couldn't. So there's that's the big difference. I think we worked with better equipment, more lights and stuff like that, and we could do things production design wise that we couldn't do before. So yeah, it was kind of freeing. But I guess it's also the demands of the script. I think the script's a little bit more complicated in terms of mounting it than with Violator. Violator was sort of designed because we knew how much money we had to work with. So I sort of wrote to the budget. So it was designed to be a very small, very intimate kind of film. This sort of allowed ourselves to open ourselves up a little bit more in the storytelling. So yeah, it sort of demanded more budget and more time.
I was wondering also, I don't want to spoil too much the movie, obviously, for people who have not seen it. I would recommend people check it out whenever they can. But because, you know, one of them appears right at the start of the movie, I was wondering if the kind of oily black monsters, if you had a hand in the design, or if that's like what you dreamed, you know, that it would look like.
I think it's part a little bit of both, but I did have an idea for the design of the creature. I had a rough peg of what I wanted, but it was the production design team who sort of like gave it a little bit more life, and the prosthetics team also. But I had a very basic idea of what I wanted. I just wanted it to be something. Well, what you see in the film is pretty much what I described to the team. So yeah, I mean, it was always tied into the darkness as something very physical. That was always the idea behind the creatures and even the drug that they had in the film. It's all tied into the idea of darkness being something tactile. Mm-hmm. So there was always that sort of like philosophy behind the design.
I was wondering, so was it just kind of mainly inspired by your dream, or was there any kind of outside influence? It's just that when I was watching it, I kind of, it like reminded me a little bit of like Under the Skin.
I mean, when I started writing it, of course, all these influences came into play. I've never been shy about like telling people what influenced my work, because I'm sort of like a voracious horror freak. So all this information is just in my head. Plus, I live in the Philippines. We have sort of like a history of ghost stories and mythology that persists to this day. I mean, I still sort of like hear stories in the city about people seeing weird shit. So I'm sort of like a collector of things like that. So it's all in my head. So when I started turning it into a script, then I started drawing from a lot of influences. I've always been actually a big fan of Under the Skin, not just the creature, but the entire film and the way it was sort of made, the whole construction of that film has always been almost inspirational because it looks really cool, but you know that you can pull it off with, you don't really need that much money to pull something like that off. That's not meant to be a diss on the film, because it's sort of like, I just love the way it feels so lo-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that energy was always very, and I've always been a fan of Glazer's work, but Under the Skin in particular. And yeah, a lot of people have pointed that out, and I see the similarity definitely, but I always argue that it's really based on the drug in the film. But yeah, I mean that's not a bad peg, to be honest.
I mean, like, it's good. I mean, Under the Skin's probably my favorite film in the last decade. So, like,
it's up there for me too.
What were the kind of other influences? You know, I was just like, also when I was watching it, like with the safe house, just the way it is, it's kind of surreal, and it's obviously a very different color palette, but it kind of gave me that vibe of like the Red Room and Twin Peaks and stuff like that.
Well, the Twin Peaks is a constant influence. I don't know if it comes out subconsciously or not, but very specifically, I think the idea for the inspiration for the safe house, I think I'm drawing from a lot of like British Gothic ghost stories, films like Woman in Black and a lot of the Hammer films that had a very big influence on me as a fan. So I think when I was sort of like imagining the safe house, I was thinking about those films. That's why it sort of came out like that it didn't look very Asian. But the weird influence and the thing that I was sort of like discussing with the team when we were in pre-production, the weird non-horror influence was In the Mood for Love. I was using visuals from the film as pegs on how I wanted it to be lit and how I wanted it to be framed. Of course, we didn't blatantly go that way, but it was sort of like hovering over the whole thing. In the Mood for Love was sort of like a spiritual influence on the design, at least.
Okay.
And I've always looked at and speaking of, since I already mentioned that I was influenced by Gothic films, I mean, the safe house sequences were sort of like my haunted house riff. You know, I was trying to, when I was writing and directing it, I was thinking, pretending that I was making my own sort of like haunted house film. So I think that sort of like came into play.
Was there any, I mean, I'm sorry for my ignorance, but was there any influence from like kind of Filipino films, or is there, I'm kind of, unfortunately, I don't have a great awareness of Filipino horror or the history of Filipino horror.
Well, a lot of the early 70s horror films from the Philippines, the really good ones, were also sort of like influenced by British ghost films, very gothic kind of feel to it. And I think it lends itself well to the culture, because sort of like we sort of like this soap opera, Spanish melodramatic culture as far as our mass entertainment is concerned. So I think it sort of like dovetails neatly into that. There were a lot of like gothic films from the 70s that I saw in really bad, with really bad copies, that were sort of influential in their own way. So yeah, there was always that. I keep drawing from that a lot in my work. Because a lot of the newer sort of like horror films in the last 10 years or 20 years, they sort of took a different tack. The really good ones took a different tack into something more modern, a little bit more progressive stuff. I haven't seen any gothic films of note. But if there are a lot of Filipino films from the 70s and 80s that were sort of in that tradition as well. So.
I can't think of any major gothic. But the last kind of gothic film that I probably saw was something like, in terms of over the top gothic, it's probably like Crimson Peak.
Crimson Peak, yeah. Or something like The Others, for example, which is a little bit earlier than that.
I was just thinking of like the most recent thing, because The Others is like 20 years ago now.
Way back. Yeah.
I think like 2001, I think.
Yeah, but I was reading something a few weeks ago that the original Woman in Black is being released on DVD. So I haven't seen that, the one with the scary scene. Supposedly, that sort of like was banned from TV. Oh, I only saw the Daniel Radcliffe version, the newer one. I only saw that, which I liked.
Yes. Yeah. I've not actually seen the original Woman in Black. Yeah. Actually, I've seen the Daniel Radcliffe hole in my horror knowledge.
Mine too. I'm kind of waiting out for it. I kind of want to see what it looks like.
Yeah. I think I'll probably pick that up too. I was going to ask you about, so in the movie, there's not a lot of, I mean, the movie makes sense. It's not like a movie you watch where you're like, you get to the end of it. Like, I'm trying to think of a movie off the top of my head, like Beyond the Black Rainbow, where you're like, what the hell was that? You can kind of parse out the information yourself. But there's not a lot of hand-holding in the movie. You're kind of put directly into this world. Were you at all like nervous about how audiences would react to that, of just being like, oh, what's going on, you know?
I kind of was at the start. I kind of was, because I sort of wrote it the way I shot it. I don't think there was anything that I took out that could be called exposition of any sort. There was one point where I toyed with the idea of putting a title card at the start, sort of like how they describe the world at the start of some films, some horror films. But we decided against it. I think nobody thought it was a good idea, except for myself. And then I just jumped it, because I was concerned at first if they could get sort of like the narrative membranes that connect everything. But yeah, then we just went with it. I think because a lot of people who weren't aware of the script and who weren't aware of what we were doing saw rough cuts of it, and they sort of got where it was going. They even sort of like filled in the blanks themselves. Some of them even better than originally intended. So that sort of like calmed down our nervousness, whether it would be too opaque or not. So we just went with it. I mean, I could like break it down and explain everything, but I mean, it's gonna make a far worse film if I do that. So we just stuck with what we had.
So you won't be giving further explanation. You won't make a prequel explaining the origins of the oily black monsters or anything like that.
I do want to do like, you remember when the first Matrix came out, they had all these side stories that were going on in the universe. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an interesting thing for me to explore. I kind of sort of like writing scraps. There are like little stories about people in this world. I kind of also have an origin story for the woman in the safe house, but nothing to really explain what was going on. It's just more people experiencing weird stuff in this world. So that's how far I'd go.
Yeah.
In that direction, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, you know, watching it, I could have seen spin-offs, like the man in the forest at the start, the woman in the safe house, you know, like I could have been like, oh, what's their story? Like, you know, I was, you get kind of just a nugget of their story and you're like, oh, what's going on there? Yeah. So
yeah. I actually kind of want to do a story based on the drug dealer. Cause I think he might have a colorful history. I haven't explored it yet, but in the back of my mind, I think there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah. Not like, I liked the drug dealer character, Kendrick, sitting in this big chair. Yeah. I definitely think he would have a colorful history. So yes, I would definitely watch a spin-off film based on that character.
I'll work on it. See.
I was also wanting to talk about how much you discuss, because I wrote their name down because I was intrigued about this. How much you discussed the sound design with the sound designer Karine Sandy Jose, because the sound design of this film is really good and really adds to the atmosphere.
Yeah. Well, Corinne's sort of like a multi-award winning sound designer in the Philippines. She's done so much really good stuff. And I was just sort of lucky because we were friends before I became a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So I could sort of like get her into my team real easy because she's kind of hard to book because she's kind of in demand. But so I sort of pulled the friendship card from time to time whenever we work. And I think that adds something to the synergy of the workflow because we can sort of like, I can sort of like tell her what I want without being too detailed, just give her the room to play around. And then it's so easy to the back and forth with the sound design. It's very organic and very, very stress-free because she sort of gets what I want without me having to necessarily explain what I want. Mm-hmm. There was just this, I think the one note that I gave her to sort of like get her off on the sound design was that I wanted at least the darkness to sound like they were underwater. Mm. I wanted that sense of feeling suffocated somehow. I think that was the trigger note that started everything. But pretty much everything else was her playing around and we sort of like sifting through it and then picking what works and what doesn't. So it's a very organic workflow. And she immediately knows what I want. There are parts of the film where it sounds like score, but it's actually sound design, and vice versa. There's a lot of stuff that sounds like sound design, but actually score. So there's that. This is the first time I got someone to score the whole film, and it was also just fortunate that they knew each other. So the synergy sort of like fell into place.
Yeah, it did feel very fluid watching the movie. Mm-hmm. There was times where I was kind of like, oh, is that sound design or is that score? That's, like I'm not sure, but I'm into it.
we've had projects before where I couldn't afford a scorer or deliberately didn't get a scorer, and she would use the sound design to like give it quote unquote music, mm-hmm. which was a really, really great exercise, I think. And I kind of want to do that again for the upcoming films to try and score through sound design.
I was also going to ask you, in terms of like the shoot of the film, was there any on-set disasters, or what was the biggest challenge during the shoot?
Biggest challenge. I don't know if this was, it was a challenge initially to figure out how to shoot the darkness, because we were already discussing rigs, or could we shoot outside, or could we simulate a city inside the studio? And I think we spent a considerable amount of time trying to figure that out. But in the end, we just decided to shoot the darkness, literally, with just the cell phone light and just a few like lights here and there to sort of like help it out. But I don't think there were any major challenges as far as the production was concerned. There's a rig didn't work, and we were delayed for like, I don't know, 6 hours, but we pulled through. We managed to get the shots that we wanted. So yeah,
that I think that stood out for me, the stuff with the darkness. I think it stood out for me because for another thing that I do, a kind of spin-off to this show, I do a monthly Guilty Pleasures podcast, where I look at guilty pleasure horror movies of the 21st century. And like the one I was recording recently, that I watched a film of just the day before, was Legion. And there's parts in that movie you just can't see what's happening. I was kind of impressed. I was like, you shot the darkness, but it's, you can see what's happening.
It was sort of like challenging in a way, because we had a moving camera, and it was pitch black inside the studio. Right. So we had to sort of coordinate how we moved and how the camera moved in a way that the actors wouldn't bump into them, because they couldn't see anything either. But I think later on they told me that they loved how that we shot it in real darkness, because it felt very immersive for them, and was sort of like an added layer of method acting in a way, because they were really in the dark, literally. Couldn't move around too much, couldn't see anything. So sort of added to the performance. But yeah, that was sort of the initial challenge, was how we could have the camera move and not damage anything.
I was also wondering about, like, you've played at quite a few festivals. You talked a little bit about Neuchâtel there, and you also played at Fantasia. You must have been pleased how well they seem to have been received at those festivals. You got nominated for an award at Neuchâtel. You got a special mention in your category at Fantasia. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was cool. I've always wanted to be part of as many genre fests as I could. Because when my first feature came out, we sort of went around, and we got into BFAN, and we got into New York Asian. But I've always kept stock of all the genre fest that I wanted to be part of back then, because I wanted to go also. So it was kind of like I was really stoked when we got into both Neuchâtel and Fantasia, and in the company of those films as well, because I was kind of familiar with some of the films that were in our category. And it's also, I think it's kind of corny, but I think it's also gratifying to see the film play out outside the country. And the irony of it was that I think a lot of people in the festivals saw it first in a cinema. We've never shown it here in a cinema. Even I haven't seen it inside a cinema. So that's sort of like the surreal part of it. It's also very gratifying, and I'm sort of and use that, because we really designed the whole thing to be seen in a cinema. The darkness was supposed to be really keyed in to the fact that we were showing it inside the cinema. Then the pandemic happened, and it just got shown online. And so I was pretty excited that both Neuchâtel and Fantasia showed it in a...
Yeah. Is it likely? I mean, how, in terms of like the situation in the Philippines, is it likely to be seen in a theater anytime soon, or?
Probably not anytime soon, but I'm still gonna keep bugging my producers to sort of like book even just one night to show it, just for the sake of like showing it inside a movie house. But I don't think it'll be anytime soon. Theaters will be probably won't be opening up. Maybe next year would be the earliest, sometime next year. So let's see.
Well, I certainly hope you get the chance to watch your own movie in the cinema.
Yeah.
Sometime soon.
Couldn't even give it a tech run. So I was kind of hoping at the very least, test the DCP, I could see it on screen. But no, that hasn't happened yet. So maybe someday.
Well, I mean, like I say, I mean, I suppose it must be some consolation that it has gone down so well at those festivals, and people seem to have really responded to it.
Oh, definitely. It's always a gratifying, in my experience at least, when a film of mine or a film we worked on gets shown outside the country. It did get good buzz here when it came out. There was a festival here last year where we had a very special series of screenings as part of the festival, a local festival. So that was very gratifying as well, and more so because it was the Philippines. But yeah, it's always the thing that I miss is the Q&As, the physical Q&As, because you sort of see a different perspective on the film when you have foreign audiences ask you questions. Sometimes odd questions that I sort of keep thinking about, the trivial questions even, that are sort of fascinating to think about why they even ask that. So that's sort of like the thing that I wish I experienced more with Midnight. Particular, because I feel it's something that a lot of people might have a lot of questions for. But all in all, I mean, I'm just glad it's going around and it's getting shown and it's getting screened. And hopefully we have another run here locally, because a lot of people haven't seen it yet here. And they're asking me questions when they can see it again. So yeah, but maybe over the next few months.
Right. I'm fascinated now in terms of like the virtual Q&A at Neuchâtel. Did you get any particularly offbeat or kind of odd questions that the kind of type you were talking about?
Not necessarily. They were interesting questions. They were all good questions about the politics of it, but nothing odd in particular stood out. I mean, if I may share, though, when we showed my first film in Hamburg, I got a question I couldn't answer quite as easily as I thought I would. Somebody asked me if Filipinos smoke a lot. And where did that come from? And then I realized everybody in the film was smoking.
Oh, okay.
So I just said, yeah, but I'm not sure how to answer the question. But it sort of stuck with me for many days. It's a fascinating question, why somebody would pick up on that. So yeah, those are the kind of questions I sort of live for, that sort of like hope people would, and it gives me a slant the film at an angle that I haven't seen it from yet.
I suppose less people smoke nowadays, so like,
yeah.
I don't know, I'm trying to think.
I
still don't know why they would ask that, but I'm just trying to think of the perspective of just like more places ban smoking now in Europe. I don't.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Yep. I mean, it does seem. It does seem like a very odd, like quite. You know, like I can't imagine. I'm just thinking. I can't imagine, like, you know, if I'd seen one of the many French films where everybody's smoking, that being, like, my first question to come to mind. I've been like, the French seem to smoke a lot.
or Hong Kong films. They smoke a lot. But yeah, maybe we do smoke a lot. I don't know. I've quit, so I wouldn't know.
I don't know. I quit many years ago. Oh, dear. It is, yeah, it just seems like, it does seem like a very offbeat question. Like, it's a bit like, if you know, you mentioned Hong Kong films there, it's a bit like, you know, Hong Kong films often have, like, a lot of kind of like eating scenes, like dinner sequences. People are always eating in Hong Kong films. But it's not the first thing I would ask, being like, you know what? Hong Kong people seem like they love snacks.
They love noodles.
A lot of noodle slurping going on. So, like, is that the main thing? Anyway, right. We'll get back on course. That question threw you and has thrown this interview. So I was wondering as well, like, you know, I suppose we've talked a little bit about Under the Skin and some other horror movies like that. So that kind of answers this question. But I'm going to ask it anyway. The movie's quite a kind of slow burn horror. Is that the kind of horror that you personally respond to the most?
I think so. I think I've been, without realizing it, I think I realized that I liked that kind of horror when the Japanese stuff came out in the 90s. And I found myself fascinated with the very slow burn films, and not much happens for most part of it. And then when something does happen, it just sticks with you. So I think that was sort of like an eye opener in a sense, but I've always liked that kind of horror. I think more so as a filmmaker than as an audience. I do like watching films like that, that specific kind of rhythm in horror, something I've always been attracted to. But although I do like all sorts, but specifically more as a filmmaker, I think it sort of like it's the same rhythm I have as a storyteller, so I think that's why I sort of drawn to it. So yeah, but I do sort of like all sorts of horror wise, the gory funny stuff. I have a deep love for it, so it's not necessarily just that. But I think it informs the process. My fascination for that specific type of horror informs it.
We're unlikely to see you make a kind of Evil Dead 2 style movie anytime soon.
I kind of want to do one though, but let's see.
I know you're a big fan of horror. Generally, and I saw an interview with you in the NME where you were saying that you might even be a bigger fan of horror literature than even horror cinema.
Yes, only in the sense that in the last like 10 years I've been reading a lot of horror fiction, new horror fiction, and I was sort of, this is sort of how I've always seen horror, how far you can take it. I think a lot of writers are taking it farther than most filmmakers. And not to say that horror cinema is in a rut. No, it's actually very, very robust and thriving. these days. I mean, I run out of time to watch all the stuff that I want to watch because there's so much good stuff out there. But in terms of sort of like expanding the language or trying to come up with new ways to scare people or find fear in the unlikeliest things, I think that's what a lot of horror fiction, the new horror fiction, does for me. It's inspirational in that way, sort of informs also the way I sort of look at stories now. Where can I find the next story and get away from the tropes? So there's a lot more. I get a lot more mileage from horror fiction.
I you know, you were saying there, get away from the tropes, and I feel like that is something. It's obviously a clear thing you want to do. Like, you know, watching like Midnight in a Perfect World, you know, you say it's inspired by like kind of haunted house movies, particularly the safe house section. And you can tell that to an extent, but it doesn't lean into, you know, it's not like a Conjuring movie. It doesn't lean into any of the kind of natural tropes of that said genre.
Yeah, I mean, I have nothing against that. I mean, I enjoyed Conjuring films. The first one in particular, I think, was really a blast. As I saw it in the theater, and that was one of the funnest times I've had inside a cinema. But
yeah,
it's just to get away from that and try to find some other shadow, if you will, in the trope. See where it can take it, bend it a little maybe. It's really not about abandoning the tropes. It's sort of like finding a new wrinkle in it, trying to see if you can take it someplace it hasn't been before. So yeah, and I don't know. It just becomes when I try to write something that sort of like follows a kind of template, I sort of get bored. So I like when the few times I've sort of like asked to write for hire, I sort of end up doing something that wasn't originally intended, because I just can't color inside the lines too much anymore. Not that I wouldn't want to at some point. Maybe there would come a time when, I never say never. I mean, there might come a time when I just want to make a good movie and see a fun movie and just do some kind of traditional subgenre exercise, maybe a slasher film or whatever. I'm very much open to that, but I think it's instinctive also. If you're a fan and then you're also a creator, you sort of try to find a new way of playing the riff, if you will, because it's all been done many times before, and you try to wanna figure out a way to make it a little bit fresh. I think it's instinctive. Like, although I won't close my doors to it, I'm not sure if I can come up with a zombie film, because I haven't figured out how to tell a zombie story fresh. I mean, I watch a lot of them, I enjoy a lot of them, but trying to figure out a way to make it fresh, I'm a little bit lost. I haven't really sat down to think about it, but off the top of my head, I feel a little bit lost in that sense. So I'm not making plans to come up with a zombie film anytime soon. But if a good idea comes out that sort of like pushes the envelope a little bit, maybe.
Zombie films are kind of a funny one, I think, because, like, particularly after the kind of Shaun of the Dead and the Dawn of the Dead remake, there was like a million zombie films came out from like the mid 2000s to now, and you do sometimes think like, I have seen like every version of this, but then every so often you'll get something. Like, you know, that film, like, One Cut of the Dead that came out a couple of years
ago. Oh, yeah, that's great.
A totally fresh twist. And I'm like, all right. And like, so I really like zombie films, but Yeah, sometimes you do just think, you know, there's no new way to do this, but there still is. Like,
Actually, there is. Funny you mentioned that film. I mean, I didn't think too much of it coming into it. I wasn't expecting much. But then, as I mean, just 10 minutes into it, I was having fun. If it had ended up being just a straightforward zombie film, it still would have been fun. But then it went all the way to that twist, and yeah, that was great. That was fresh. And there's another Japanese zombie film that I kind of like. It's not that fresh in a sense, but I've always loved it. I've always rewatched it for the fun of it. It's I Am a Hero. I don't know if you're familiar with I Am a Hero.
No.
It's based on a manga.
Okay.
It's kind of pretty recent. I think that was 3 4 years ago it came out.
I am a hero. Okay.
I Am a
Yeah, yeah.
Hero. Yeah. It's
Okay.
part of a very long manga. I mean, the manga's great, but so this is just a portion of the story. But yeah, it's traditional zombie. It's a traditional zombie film in many ways. It's Japanese. It's a traditional zombie film in many ways, but it's really, really fun.
Okay, I'll need to check that out. I've definitely not seen that one. But yeah, there is some fun, kind of Japanese zombie movies. I don't have you ever seen Versus?
Oh yes, of course.
Yeah, cool.
That was great. That's
Yes, that's just
old school great. Yeah.
yeah. That's, I mean, that's a different zombie film.
Yes. Yeah, it's understatement to say it's
It's
different.
completely mental. I was going to ask you as well, and maybe this is just my ignorance, but I feel like not a whole lot of Filipino films make it over here, and I was wondering if you think of yourself in any way as a kind of standard bearer for Filipino cinema.
I wouldn't go that far,
Okay.
but I hope so at some point. But I mean, there are a lot of filmmakers who sort of like go to a lot of the big festivals, constantly go to a lot of the big festivals, and I think they're more in the forefront of representation in sense of on a world level of because I only do I'm mainly in genre. I think I'm gonna be stuck by choice in doing a specific kind of film. But yeah, I kind of hope, at the back of my head, I kind of hope that this sort of like pushes a lot of like young horror filmmakers to sort of like push their craft and the envelope of their stories a little bit more. I know several who are doing good stuff and who have really, really fun ideas. So hopefully that's sort of like you sort of like set the spark for a lot of aspiring horror filmmakers back home who want to sort of keep doing what they're doing in the genre, not branching out to like more commercial fare, which is inevitable if you really in the Philippines, it's inevitable for you to sort of like do TV or do something more a little bit more commercial. But I've sort of stuck to it. It's probably not a good economic choice, but I'm stuck to it because I don't know, I just in this for the fun. So I'm hoping. I do know there are a lot of like young aspiring filmmakers who want to do horror. I've worked with a few of them and they're really, really good. But you know, you just ho sort of hope you shepherd them into the right direction.
Absolutely. Well, I hope to see more stuff from you and more stuff from young filmmakers out there in the Philippines, because that's one of the kind of cool things about starting this show. You know, like, obviously I'm a big horror fan, but obviously mainly aware of the kind of traditional horror centers of like UK, US, Japan, Korea, stuff like that, but like Australia, but I've found other stuff in other parts of the world, going to more festivals and talking to a lot of people. So it's always exciting to find new stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like horror ground being staked in Southeast Asia as well, not just in the Philippines. I mean, in the Philippines, there's very few right now, I think because it's a little bit more expensive to make a horror film than like romantic comedies or something. So, but in Southeast Asia, there's sort of like a thriving scene. There's a lot of like very fascinating filmmakers and films coming out. But horror is in a good place now, generally, everywhere you go. I mean, this is so much stuff. If you're a fan, you're really going to be overwhelmed. I tend to be overwhelmed a little bit because there's just so much to choose from and
I
not
think
enough
so.
time.
I think so. And there's so many different things coming out and all over the world, and it's really hard to keep up with. And yeah, in like new countries, like all the time, I've noticed like a rise in like Indonesian horror in the last couple of years, like with
Yeah,
like
Indonesian
Joko
stuff's really
Anwar and
good.
stuff like that, so all sorts of different places.
And good stuff too. It's not just
Yeah,
like
absolutely good stuff.
it's really, really good stuff. I've been watching a lot of like UK and Australian stuff. So I think some of them's a little bit like a few years back, but still good, still worth recommending to a lot of people.
Well, before we wrap up, do you want to make any recommendations and then also tell us what you are working on next?
Oh, recommendations. What was the last good film? Well, the last for the during the pandemic, I think I don't know if you've seen the new Ben Wheatley.
Oh,
I
In the
think
Earth. No,
In the
I'm
Earth.
it's
Yeah.
on my watch list.
I just love that. Seriously love that one. And I saw something in Fantasia that I was really, really fascinated by. It's also a British film. It's called Martyrs Lane. It's just about it's this kid who has an imaginary friend of sorts. At least I don't want to spoil it too much, but and it has this sort of like fairy tale like a tone to it, although it's set in the present day. And it's very, very subtle in terms of the scares, but I was really drawn to it. I managed to catch it on its last day. It was about to expire my watch window for it at Fantasia, so I managed to catch it before it expired. And so glad I did. I think it's getting picked up now by Shudder.
Yes, it will. It's
So.
it's on. Definitely. I'm not sure if it's on Shudder when we record this interview, but definitely by the time it's out, I'm pretty sure it is. It'll be available in Shudder in the UK, US, Australia, New Zealand. So yes,
Yeah,
I've
that was
definitely
the
seen
last.
adverts for it.
Yeah, that was the last one that I really, really, really liked.
Okay. And cutting back to yourself, what will you be working on next? If you can tell us.
I'm actually Ken. I'm, but we're still sort of like in development stage. I'm working on a series. It's a horror series. I'm working on a series. We already went to NAFF in Korea, the project market, to sort of present it there. And now I'm in the middle of writing the pilot episode and writing the whole episode breakdown for it. It's going to be six, eight episodes. And I also have a film that I've been developing for almost 2 years now. That sort of like got delayed by the pandemic, but we're getting back to it. It's a botanical horror film. So that's the two things that I'm going to be directing, but I'm also currently writing for a lot of other directors as well. So I don't know what will come out of that, but hopefully we get to go into production soon for those films. Some of them are horror-ish. Some of them are slightly science fictional, but yeah. So those are, I don't know if that's too vague.
Oh, no, that's okay. For the ones you're directing, the series and the feature film, could you give us titles, or is that not a thing in the moment?
The working title for the series is Goliath. And the working and the title for the feature is Dear Wormwood.
Dear Wormwood. So, okay.
Yeah. So those are the we're in script development stage for both, and trying to get funding.
Well, I will keep an eye out for them, and it just leaves me to say thank you very much for coming on the show, and please do come out on again anytime. Maybe to talk about that show, or to talk about the other film.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, anytime. Thank you. And thank you for having me. And I'm going to look for your podcast on Spotify as soon as we're done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was my guest Dodo there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. I'd also like to thank you, listener, for tuning into this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you can be sure to make those reviews 5 stars, that would be great, as otherwise, the algorithm thinks we're shit. Weird, I know, but that's just the way it is. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to join me next time, when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.